What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.
Hey, everyone. It's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
All right, it's season 20, episode 6 of I Should Be Writing. Hi there. Welcome to I Should Be Writing. This is a podcast for wannabe fiction writers, and I am your host, Mer Lafferty. Been doing it since 2005 when I was a wannabe fiction writer, and then started traditionally publishing in the teens when all my listeners said I had to stop calling myself that. So I had to change the tagline of the show. But I've gotten lots of books out. I've been podcasting for a long time. So if you have any curiosities about my credentials, you can find them easily online. And whenever somebody gives you writing advice, check out their credentials, because they might just be saying stuff. But I am delighted to welcome onto the show today Gwenda Bond, author of The Frame Up, which is out now. Gwenda's been a good friend of mine for some time. I was with her when she was drafting The Frame Up on a writer's retreat, and I'm just so excited to have you. How are you, Gwenda?
I'm great. It's always good to hang out with you. Yeah, you basically rescued this book. I don't know if it would have gotten finished in a timely manner had we not gone on that retreat.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an interesting retreat. So I want to talk about that a little bit later. But first, I want to give my boss cone report. And Gwenda, we usually talk about what we've been up to. If you want to talk about what you've been up to, you can. And if you don't want to, then that's fine. But I went to boss cone and I'd had a thought in my head for a while. And I read from Chaos Terminal, but I just really was itching to get this thought down. It was like a chapter one of a new book. And I wrote it that afternoon. And then I read it at my reading that night. And everybody I told that to were shocked.
Yeah, like, no, but that's yeah, because that's a lunatic thing to do. Read it.
So glad I thought it was stupid too. Oh boy, man!
I didn't think it was stupid. I thought very ballsy.
The word people have used is ballsy. I mean, I liked it. I thought it was a fun beginning, so I read it. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I just like closed my eyes and crossed a freeway while all of my writer friends are going, "Don't do it!" And I got to the other side, okay. And I'm like, "What? What's the problem here?" Because you, Elizabeth Baer, Joshua Bilmes, I mean, everyone's like, "Why would you do that?" And the problem is,
very impressive. It's very impressive if you can write a draft and, you know, then just be able to read it. I mean, I know people who can do that, clearly. You're one of them now.
Oh, wow. New club. Yay.
New club.
Anyway, so I started a new book. That was fun. And I read from Chaos Terminal, and people liked that, too. And overall, the con was good.
I would give you props for writing while at a convention, because I never managed to do that.
Yeah, I did it, like, first day before anything really required my attention. So, yeah, I didn't do it anymore after that. Well, I was at a con seeing my kid and my husband was there. So, you know, there were people to see, even if I didn't like anybody at the con, which I did liked lots of people. Anyway, Gwenda, what have you been up to writing-wise?
Oh, what have I been up to writing-wise? Well, I just, I've got two books that are late. So I had a year of Doom and then broke my ankle right when I started to get back on track. Although I seem to be making a miraculous recovery because I recovered. I had surgery basically a month ago and I've been out of my boot for at least a week and
wow.
just walking in regular shoes and it seems fine. I mean, you could feel the screw under the skin if that's if you're into that. But but it doesn't look that bad.
Cringe.
I'm working on both the follow-up to The Frame Up, which is another standalone, and a historical fantasy series that will be my first under the pen name Gemma Bowen.
Gemma Bowen. Both of which will be Okay.
I thought that I've written too many kinds of things, and so historical Regency fantasy needed its own name. So as to stop confusing people with the fact that I just sort of dilettante write whatever I feel like.
Well, I want to talk about that. There's like so many, when you start your career, you're thinking, I want to write this or I want to write that. And I don't know, maybe I'm naive, but I had the thought that event career, I would be able to write in different genres if I got the idea. And you've done that. You've done TV tie-in with Stranger Things. You've done Lois Lane tie-ins.
Lane.
Yeah. And you've done, you've done rom-com and This Is Your Mystery.
Middle grade.
So.
Lots of YA.
Yeah, lots of YA. Are you seeing this as a, do you see this as a down, is this overall bad career-wise, or is you just pulling a pen name out of your back pocket like part of the thing you do? And did you have that in your back pocket? And if not, where did you keep it?
No, it okay. was it was actually suggested. The publisher asked if I would be willing to do something that was more Regency sounding. I think pen names are just more common now, and they want, also publishers love a debut, and so since this is a big departure, and I do have another publisher, so like these books may be coming out in same years. Like I think there is something smart about separating off, and you can always unseparate it, but it's a little bit, this one made sense to me because all my other books I think have the same feel, and this certainly I think people who like my regular books will like it, and it'll be an open pseudonym, so it's like no one who is already a fan hopefully is like going to be surprised. But like for the Regency audience that these fantasy books are really directed at, I think maybe there would be less crossover with my other books. And so it makes sense to me. And also it's fun to come up with a name. I wanted it to be Gwendolyn Banks because my grandmother's name was Gwendolyn and it would be Gwendolyn Puts Money in the Banks, you see. But they were like, no, here's a they actually gave me a couple lists of names. And then, but actually I think the one that my agent and I came up with was not on the list of names to mix and match and create. But it was fun. I mean, and that was kind of like, that's kind of my thing is like, it was fun. And when they proposed it, I thought, well, that'll be fun. Like to write something under a different name.
And it's really for people like at bookstores or searching things online, because if you can tell your fans what books you have coming out and they'll understand. Right. Whereas as our friend Ursula, her name is on her children's books. So when she writes her more bloody or otherwise upsetting or terrifying adult books, you don't have a parent who's going to pick up a book with a rabbit on the front being eaten by mushrooms and think, my kid will love this. So,
yeah.
I forgot what Ursula's new book is called. It's bugging me. But it has a similarly terrifying cover.
What Moves the Dead, or is that the first one?
What Moves the Dead is the first one, and the one that came after. I can picture the cover. Anyway, but yeah, for Ursula, it's very important.
What Feasts at Night.
What Feasts at Night.
What Feasts at Night.
Wow. Ursula's got good titles.
He does.
Yeah. So let's talk about The Frame Up. That is the book we're launching today, and I did not get a chance to grab my copy, so you're going to have to hold one up. All right.
Now they're everywhere. They're everywhere. I wanted to write a heist book because it just seemed like a challenge. I love heist stories. Mm-hmm. And I had an idea about a painting that's not simply a painting or that has an interesting history. And so I just kind of immersed myself in heist movies and books until I was convinced there's no way I could do it, and then started to write it. I do think heists are hard. It's interesting because I do think, like, so it's hard to talk about this book without like saying too much and giving away spoilers, but
sure.
Basically, the main character, Danny, when she was 17, flipped on her mother, who was probably the world's best art thief and part of a crew of thieves who have magic. And her mom has been in prison ever since, and Danny has kind of been on the road by herself. And so her mother's mysterious former partner shows up where she's shaking down a douchebag for money, which is kind of how she fills her bank account. She finds scumbags and then sort of fleeces them and gives part of their money to like whatever women that they've screwed over. Okay. And she has a great border collie with her. And this gentleman, Archer, tells her that if she steals this painting from this legendary collection called the Fortress of Art, colloquially, that no one's ever been allowed in, run by kind of a billionaire type who died 5 years ago. And his will has prevented anyone from being in it or selling it off until now. It's about to go up for auction. And if she can get the painting from it, then he will reunite her with her mother, which is something that she wants. And so she has to go back home and kind of work her way back into the old crew because she has very little time to pull off this job. And so there's also like the FBI art crime team, you know, so I really wanted it to be set in a version of our world with magic where these thieves have different magical gifts, but they also have to deal with the realistic world of what when you're doing a crime. Mm-hmm. You know, like I didn't want it to just make it too easy. So I basically tried to write a book that would work on both levels. The mystery that plays fair on both the magic side and the reality side.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy. Easy peasy.
Yeah, sounds it.
I mean, actually, when people say this book is fun, I'm like, that means that I pulled it off. Because mm-hmm. my favorite heist things are fun and breezy. And it certainly was not easy to write. So whenever someone says, you know, a book is fun and it was difficult to write, you're like, okay, like you're not, the seams are not showing too much.
That's great. I love heist things as well and always fear I'm not clever enough to write one. So
if I can do it, you can do it.
But one thing you wanted to talk about was I was with you when you were drafting this book because in 2022, we went to the beach together for a writer's retreat, for an unplanned writer's retreat that basically came to pass when my family was trying to get a beach house for vacation and did 2 weeks of reservations thinking we would cancel one of them before everyone decided, but it got too late. And finally, I'm just like, I'll take the first week as a writing retreat for my friends. And I actually didn't think anybody would come because it was like last minute or whatever. But no, we had Gwenda, we had Ursula and Kevin came down and Andrea Phillips. Is that it? Cameron was going to come, but she didn't.
Right. No, it was great.
Yeah.
It was great.
So what did you get out of the writer's retreat? Do you do that kind of thing often or grab it when the option comes up all of a sudden?
I think I did do it. And I think I'm going to do it more. I do think there's a lot of research, actually. Like I read a book this year called The Nature Fix with one of my book clubs here in town. And there's all this research about how being in a different environment than your normal actually can increase creativity.
Hmm.
And so I really do think there is, and there's also the thing of being unchained from your everyday responsibilities, right?
Yes.
Like, especially if you can just like make feeding yourself easy at a retreat, make, you know, like, you know, we did some walks, but we basically just were writing and then watching the after party at night.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about writing stuff. And there was, I remember there were hardly any restaurants open because COVID had still sort of decimated and we could only do like takeout from like two places.
Right.
So we did a lot of grocery runs. And I think that all of those things kind of combine that you can just, I mean, I just remember like I had been having a terrible time finding time and space to work. And I remember sitting down that first morning writing 4,000 words and just feeling like I was high because it had been so long since that had happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do think like also just being like, well, I've come here to write and I'm going to do it. Damn it.
Yeah.
And I think we were both on pretty tight deadlines, mm-hmm. Too. So that also helps. But I think there's also something about being in with other people that are working in that way, like just an energy kind of thing that you sort of feed off each other.
Yeah.
I was feeding off you, Mar. Feeding off your energy.
Just an energy vampire, just sucking it up.
God, that's right.
So
yeah, so I remember, and I remember like some of my favorite parts of the book, like just that weren't planned, like characters that really I grew to like just sort of showed up on the page when I was there. So I have a very vivid sense memory of writing on that couch with the beach outside.
That was a nice house.
It was.
So what, besides putting together the heist, what challenges did you face with this book, if any?
Well, I had to do quite a bit of research into late 1800s painting academies in France, because there's an ancestor of the main character who went to one of the first traditional French painting school that allowed female students and let them do paintings from life and study in the same way that male painters got to study. And that was fascinating stuff. But just to try and immerse myself in sort of that milieu and figure out how to bring that part into the story in a natural way and in a fun way. 'Cause I actually hate it when I get to an italicized section in a book. You know, like I often am like, oh God, here we go. Like italicized letters or, you know, whatever, boring. So I really felt like if I was going to put in an italicized section, it had to hold my interest and everyone else's.
Yeah.
So hopefully it does that. But yeah, there's like a little book within a book, which I always do love actually. But it just, and it's not italicized. I think we said it in a different type, but it was italicized when I wrote it. And I was just like, my editor's like, I love this, expand it. And I was like, okay, good. So I've not committed the just skip these pages of italics sin that I hate when I encounter it in books. And it just feels gratuitous and takes me out of the main story.
So how do you write books in different voices? Because I sometimes enjoy books like that, and other times I don't, because I mean, in a couple of cases, which I won't say out loud because I don't trash books on this show, like the book within the book is better than the book, and I'm like, why are you bringing me back to reality when I want to keep reading this thing? And
well, so
I'm not implying yours is going to do
it
that
short. Still keep it short.
Yes.
I mean, I think the important thing is to know, yeah, what you're showing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the problem can be right if the weighting isn't right. Like if it feels like the stories are almost equal in the attention that they're pulling. And I mean, sometimes that can work. I mean, there are writers who do that, like a story from then and a story now, and they manage to have enough tension between them that you can have that. But I think like for most, if the book within a book is really just a way of showing exposition, right? Or of providing information that the characters can't get. It's the most interesting way to provide information that characters can't get. Then you want to get in and out like as make it as much to the point as possible, so the reader's not like, well, I wonder what happened during this break, right? Like, I think you can err a little bit more on wrapping things up in the one story, even as you leave some things hanging, just so that the reader wants to see the conclusion of is what's going on in the main story, whenever that's set. Does that make sense? Did I just...
No, it does. So did you include the entire book within the book, or did you do pieces of it?
Pieces of it. I mean, I guess it kind of is, but no, it's like there's an implication that there's probably a little more of it, but it's just like a very specific window of time that we're getting.
Right. So one thing I've been thinking about in my own writing is points of view and how to choose them. Because this became most obvious when I was writing the solo book, and that I just, for some reason, on one scene, I got stuck knowing that people have already seen the scene, and I'd also read about it via the middle grade book's point of view, and I didn't know how I was going to do it again. And mm-hmm. So I realized changing the point of view of somebody else who's in the scene, but seeing mm-hmm. it from not the main character's point of view would make it interesting. And since I kind of had that breakthrough, I've been wondering whose point of view to choose when, and when not to show somebody, like when you're hiding something or obfuscating something. There's your word for the day.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever come across stuff
that? I love point of view. I wrote my thesis in grad school. I mean, it's a very cool thing to say, on omniscient POV in YA. And so I did a lot of things. I love omniscient when it's done well. I love like a fluid POV. Every time I think I'm going to actually use it myself, I really don't. And I have had many points of view changed from books, but by editors, although not recently.
Really? That sounds like hell.
It wasn't that bad. The first draft of the Lois Lane book I wrote in third, and my editor's like, this should be first. And I'm like, okay. I was a newbie. It's not like I could have pushed back. And I do feel like it was the right call. And, you know, like I love third person. So I did want to write a book in third person. And the frame up is in third person. And then there's like this one section in someone else's POV. And at first I thought, well, I want to show a bunch of people and move around because that's how most heist stories work. But most heist stories are movies. And it also felt as if it could feel like cheating a bit. And it really is Danny's story. So I think I decided fairly early on, after some experimentation of things that just didn't feel right, that I wanted to be pretty close in Danny's head, in her POV.
Mm-hmm.
And that enables different kinds of surprises, right? And it also means that you are closer to her as the mastermind running the heist than you are in a lot of heist stories, in terms of, you know, what you need to know emotionally and all that stuff.
But doesn't the mastermind in the heist group, don't you not want to look too deeply into their head, or else you'll get all the deeper plans that we don't find out until near the very end?
Well, there's different. Okay, this is where I'm asking, put on my heist nerd hat. There's different kinds of heists, right? There's the heist where you know the plan and then the plan goes off the rails. Mm-hmm. There's a heist where some parts of the plan are concealed no matter who the main characters are and how much you know. Most heists sort of play with a little bit with both, right? And so, yes, it is tricky. Like, you have to, it's tricky to do it in a way that you're not cheating anything. So, yes, there are surprises and they're set up. But is it what the main character would be thinking about, or you just don't show them during that time when mm-hmm. they would be thinking about it? And also, there's a bunch of other people involved in the heist who have their own agendas, and there's people who are also trying to steal the thing who have their own agenda. So, you know, you have all of, you have enough balls in the air to sort of keep them moving so that the a traditional mastermind, yes, but Danny is like someone planning this with a week who's sort of doing it all on the fly. So I think there's a way in which she's still, she, it's not like your the money heist, like, you know, where this guy has been planning this forever. And yeah, so it's as much about the emotions of the relationships and who can rely on who as it is about anything else. But hopefully there are some good twists in there. But yeah, I think Danny not necessarily being able to trust everyone around her, even though she's in charge of the heist, is the, you know, is kind of how I chose to tackle that. But like every heist has its own, you know, you just got to make your rules and then stick within them or it feels like a cheat, I think.
Yeah, they're tricky.
I think it's easier to do in third person. I think first it would have been, it would have felt like cheating if you didn't know everything that she knows.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of distance there in the third person that you get.
Yeah, I think that's one thing I struggle with first person, because, I mean, I never know when to hide something that the main character is thinking. I mean, Agatha Christie did it in The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
Right.
And, but, you know, I'm not Agatha Christie. Shocker, I know.
First person slows things down, too, in a way, because you can only find out, you can only move as fast as your main character can move. So, like, if you're going to have a heavy plot book, I think sometimes it can be difficult, more difficult to do in first person. Like, I think a heist with all of its twists would be exhausting in first person.
Yeah.
Probably, like, 20K longer.
Yeah, definitely. Is there anything craft or book related that you wanted to discuss before I open up the podcast to questions?
I don't know. I'm very curious to see how people react to this book, especially because my last couple books have been romances, and this book has a romance, but it's more of a mystery. It's more of a mystery heist with fantasy elements. And so I'm a little nervous that people will be like, I wish this was a romance, because some people have been that way already. And it's like, well, it has a romance, but it really is, you know, it was never intended to be a romance. And that's where I get myself into trouble.
Yeah.
Writing whatever I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. Been there. Well, we're going to end the podcast right here. The live stream will continue with the chat and Gwenda having questions and answers. But if you would like to hear the rest of what we're talking about, you can support at patreon.com/mightymur or mightymur.substack.com and get the full episode. But for now, you can find me at merverse.com, and I'm Tuesday, Thursday, Twitch at 3:00 Eastern Time. And find the podcast wherever fine podcasts are found. Gwenda, you want to tell us where to find you online?
You can find me as at Gwenda Bond or Gwenda pretty much everywhere. Blue Sky, occasionally Twitter, not very much. Instagram, Gwenda Bond, and Threads I just got on. But Blue Sky mostly lately. And then I have a Substack because I just have not moved and can't figure it out. GwendaBond.substack.com, where I try and write pretty regularly and put up lots of dog pictures and things.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for being on the show, Gwenda. And thank you guys for listening. And we'll see you next time, because you should be writing. Thank you for listening to I Should Be Writing, the longest-running writing podcast in existence. This episode was made possible by the Fabulous, who support the podcast via Patreon or Substack. Join the Fabulous at patreon.com/mightymur or mightymur.substack.com. Theme music provided by John Anilio. Art provided by Numbers Ninja, and podcast hosting provided by Libsyn. This episode is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 license. You can find all of my books and podcasts at merverse.com.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.